Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I'm here with my audio engineer, and she's helping me out on a ongoing regular basis. So, we are a podcast and a radio show. We are on Red State Talk Radio on the weekends. We can show both Saturdays and Sundays on both channels, so you can go to the Red State Talk Radio platform to get the specifics. And we're a podcast. ThrottleUpRadio.com is our website, by the way. I would, just go on over there and take a look. We have all the podcasts archived there. And it's also available on all the podcast platforms that we're aware of at the present time, Podbeam, CastBox, Apple Play, iTunes, and a whole bunch of them. So it's easy to find us. And we are weekly, almost every week, not exactly every week, but I would say most of the time. We have a weekly show. On occasion, we have, we skip a week because of basically something comes up or, we're on travel or something, can't get to the studio. But that's kind of unusual. Most of the time, it's a weekly event for us, and we are honored to do this. Okay, we are in the midst of a special ongoing program called Think Like a Fighter Pilot. Fighter pilots actually think critically. And that basically is the bottom line. Throttle Up is all about critical thinking. And we can expand that a little bit by adding a few additional words. Often critical thinking just covers it. But we could also add to that critical thinking description. We could also say complex problem solving. There is some, aspects of that that are a little bit different, but not exactly different, but just slightly different than what you would think when you consider critical thinking. Anyway, Think Like a Fighter Pilot. We are going to be discussing that issue in great detail. But for this show, we actually have a question from a listener that we are going to address ourselves to. And we do that because we honor all of our listeners. We respect them, and we want to deal with their questions and inquiries to the extent that we are capable of doing that. So we're going to start this show by having my audio engineer read a question from a listener, and this really gets to the heart of this whole purpose of this radio show and the purpose of this special edition series. All right, so here's my audio engineer, and here's the question.
Well, hi, Kevin, and hello to your listening audience. Okay, a recent listener of Throttle Up asked for a somewhat more detailed explanation of how did the first deployed Top Gun unit come about.
Okay, thank you for that. And so we are going to address ourselves to that issue to the best of our ability. Now, the first order of business is that, and I've mentioned this a number of times, I've also mentioned this in my book. Oh, by the way, we do have a new book out. It's called The Sonic Warrior, Chronicles of a Top Gun Pioneer. And yes, I am a Sonic Warrior, early Sonic Warrior. I was on the ground floor of the Supersonic Initiative, and also I'm a Top Gun Pioneer, which means I was one of the first group of fighter pilots to get involved in a meaningful way in what we call the Top Gun Initiative. That's kind of a broad term. But commanding the first forward-deployed Top Gun unit, we were embarked aboard the USS Constellation. And I would say that we made history. We were the first to take this idea of providing close scenario combat exercises for the embarked fighter community. And so we were operating outside the box. We were way outside the box. This was not something that was typically done, but we decided to do it based upon a request. So as it turns out, in the course of events, if you will, we were involved in the build-up phase. So let me kind of set the stage here, because it's a little bit confusing. And, yeah, there's a lot of navalese and esoteric language that we use. But the situation was that I was the commander of this squadron. Okay, I was squadron commander. And we were involved in what we call build-ups. It was the build-up phase. We're getting ready to deploy aboard the USS Constellation, which, of course, was a Kitty Hawk-class carrier, one of the super carriers, or the Kitty Hawk class represents a super carrier group, class group. Okay, this was, I think, five or six aircraft carriers that were built along this dimensional line, and this is one of the first group of what we call super carriers. These were big ships, very large, probably in the order of 90,000 tons, 5,000 people, 100 airplanes. So these were huge vessels, and I was a part of an air wing. Okay, I was a part of Air Wing 9. Air Wing 9 was commanded by Captain Tony Less, a very famous naval aviator and fighter pilot, a former commanding officer of the Blue Angels. He was our air wing commander, and as a squadron commander, I operated directly under him. He was my immediate superior. Okay, so we were getting ready to build up. We were involved in build-ups, getting ready to deploy. As it turns out, the build-ups were very long. It was a long build-up period, and the reason for that is a little bit strange, I suppose, or a little bit difficult to explain. But it was because we were designated as the ready carrier. So we were basically in port, although we would go out to sea on a regular basis. And we were building up so that we had a long build-ups. We were a ready carrier. That was our designation. And finally, we did deploy, and the deployment was just short of a year. So we were at sea for a very long period of time. So we were getting ready. So we're involved in build-ups. We're getting ready to deploy in this situation and environment. And the time frame here, we were still involved with the Cold War. Okay, so this was a Cold War environment, and this was the Cold War scenario, if you will. So let me start this explanation by... And this is going to be a little bit unusual, but we also are a part of the out-of-the-box thinking crowd. And so when you come into the Throttle Up environment, you're not going to get standard fare. It's not going to happen. You're going to get stuff that is that is outside the box. You're going to get stuff that is not common, and you're going to get stuff that is definitely not conventional. Okay, we are not conventional thinkers here. And that separates us from crowd thinking, if you will, or conventional thinking. We're not particularly interested in conventional wisdom. We like to think about new things, new ideas. Innovation and creativity is part of our being. It is embedded within our DNA structure, as well as critical thinking. So that's what we are all about. We're going to do a situation analysis. That's what we're going to do. What was the situation? How did this come about in the first place? Not what we did, but how did it happen is what we're going to be addressing ourselves to on this show, in previous shows, of course, and future shows. How did this happen? Okay, what was the state of aviation? Aviation, of course, was in the middle of a major transition. We were transitioning to the fourth generation fighter, which was the F-14. The F-14 Tomcat was just entering the fleet. In other words, it was just becoming operational. Okay, what was aviation doing? Aviation was getting ready to build long-range airplanes that could fly commercially over long distances and do so economically. Now, we had relatively long-range airplanes before this time, and this time frame was, I would say, the late 1970s and the early 1980s is what the calendar time of this occurrence. That was the time of major improvements and developments in aviation in general and military aviation. Aviation in general was going more electronic. We're moving away from analog systems, and we were getting ready to make operational digital systems, computers, screens. Instead of steam gauges, we had video screens in the cockpit and stuff like that. That was starting to happen. And we had electronic controlled systems rather than cables and pulleys. We had flight computers entering the aviation field. So aviation was in the was moving very rapidly ahead. It was actually kind of an exciting time for aviation. It was open to innovation and creativity. It was open to new ideas, and there was a lot of things going on, lots and lots of things. Military aviation, of course, we were moving into a new generation of fighters. Like I said, it was the F-14 Tomcat for the Navy, and it was the F-15 for the Air Force. So military aviation was moving into the fourth generation fighter environment. Naval aviation, of course, was operating at that time. Naval aviation was operating three fighters. It was operating the F-4 Phantom. It was just starting to operate the F-14 Tomcat, and it was still operating the F-8 Crusader, albeit in a tactical reconnaissance role. All right, so we had three fighter airplanes going on in the Navy at that period of time. Aircraft carriers. We were expanding the depth and breadth of carrier operations. We were moving into what we consider to be how should I put this? a war at sea scenario that was expansive. We expanded the battle space. The sea and air battle space was expanded considerably during this period of time. We were starting to operate blue water. Now, what does that mean, to operate blue water? Blue water means that there is no divert airfield. That's what blue water means. So we were then able, and we actually perfected that during my deployment aboard the USS Constellation. And so there was no place on the oceans in which we could not operate. Right. Now, that was probably one of the most significant developments ever in the course of naval aviation, the ability to achieve that kind of operational capability. So, aircraft carrier operations were front and center. And finally, fighter aviation. What was happening with the fighter aviation, like I said, it was the F-14 was being introduced, and the F-14 community was focused on aerial combat. Okay, primarily focused on aerial combat. Aerial combat for that airplane consisted of long range and close in. Close in also could be called short range. We kind of like to use close in. It means the same thing. It just kind of a pilot preference, I guess. So, long range and close in. What were the critical operational concerns at that time? The critical operational concerns was, and actually still is today, but was beginning to emerge, which was close-in aerial combat. All right, we as a fighter community wanted to get better at that. Okay, why? Well, partly because of the experience of the F-4 community, that the F-4s came before the F-14s, of course. So we're talking about a span of about probably 20 years between the two. So the F-4 community had some rather painful lessons that it had to learn about close-in aerial combat. And these painful lessons resulted in a number of initiatives emerging within the fighter community. One of those things was, of course, Top Gun, or the Navy Fighter Weapons School. That emerged as part of the solution to some of the critical operational concerns that became recognizable within the Phantom community. Okay, now that move forward into the F-14 community. Critical operational concerns, one of the top, I would say the top critical operational concerns was close-in aerial combat. What is going on? Okay, what is going on was that we were not as prepared for that mission as we should have been. Okay, is that true today? Well, I think there's a lot of things going on that help that situation. We'll get into that later. All right. I'm very encouraged with what's going on today within that arena and with that regard. Very encouraged. But during this period of time that I'm talking about, we were very concerned about pilot performance within the close-in aerial combat environment. We're very concerned about that. There are a lot of people who didn't think that we were as prepared for that as we should have been, as we were. And so I was asked to come up with a solution for that concern. or that challenge, if you will. My solution was, okay, let's bring the Top Gun training model, bring it to carrier operations, bring it to sea. Let's bring the Top Gun training model to the aircraft carrier environment. Now, keep in mind that the Top Gun training model was just utilized from a land-based airport, if you will, or an airfield. All right, so it was performed within the context and with the confines of an airfield located somewhere on the earth. In this case, it was NAS Miramar, which of course was featured in the first Top Gun movie. That was also called Fighter Town USA. Okay. I was involved in taking this model to sea. All right. So the first carrier to employ this kind of training program or to conduct this kind of training initiative was the USS Constellation. Okay. The first air wing was Air Wing 9. And the first squadron that did this, that provided this adversary support, was my squadron, VFP-63. Okay, so that's the state of the environment. That is the situation. That's the situation analysis. Okay, so what is it about aerial combat? Well, we have long range and we have close in. Close in aerial combat is probably the most difficult thing that humans have ever done. Okay, now, what is the level of difficulty? I will give you what I think is the level of difficulty with respect to what humans have ever done and what pilots have ever done. The level of difficulty is basically I'm going to frame it this way. Okay, there are two of the most difficult things that pilots have ever done ever in the history of aviation, and they are landing a swept wing jet fighter on the deck of an aircraft carrier and flying close in aerial combat against a near peer adversary, utilizing high velocity, a swept wing supersonic capable aircraft. Those are the two things that I would consider to be the most difficult that humans have ever done. Okay, aerial combat, close-in aerial combat. What is it and how do we address ourselves to it? The first thing I want to talk about is the mission. Now, keep in mind that we are dealing with these highly capable airplanes, but we're also dealing with challenges to the human consciousness or cognition. There are cognitive challenges here that are enormous. Often they get overlooked because it's not easy to deal with this stuff, but it should be. Okay, but I'm getting ahead of myself, so let me get back to what I want to deal with respect to this initiative. So we have this capability that we bring it aboard an aircraft carrier, which is to provide adversary support for the brand new F-14 community that is deployed aboard the USS Constellation. The first order of business here, after we get the hardware in place and get the personnel in place, which we did. The first order of business is to look at what are the critical operational concerns. And the way we do this is as follows. Okay, we follow a process of inquiry and discovery. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to understand what is this air combat mission in the first place, or we're looking at something that we call mission analysis. Okay, all right, what is that? We're going to look at what are the mission objectives. We're going to specify the mission objectives, and we're going to identify the mission parameters, and we're going to also look at the human performance objectives as part of this package. Okay. The human performance objectives is often, we use a number of terms, okay? The typical term that is being, that has been used in the past, I'm not sure it's being used now. I don't know. But the typical term, if we're going to be looking at the human side of the equation, typical term is terminal proficiency objectives. Okay, what is that? Well, we use TPOs. That's kind of like the acronym for it. What is it? Terminal proficiency objectives. What are the objectives at the high level that must be achieved? What exactly do we want the pilots to be able to do? And let me state that a little bit differently. What is it that we want pilots to be able to do with respect to close-in aerial combat? Okay, fine. We have to specify them. We have to write specifications for that, and they are contained within the context of terminal proficiency objectives. Okay, what is the most difficult terminal proficiency objective in the close-in aerial combat arena, as well as the long-range aerial combat arena? What is the most difficult and most important objective? And I have done this because I was involved in this for a very long period of time for many airplanes. The most important objective is to determine the attack plan. Once you encounter the enemy airborne forces, you have to be able to sort out what's real and what's fake, and then you have to be able to figure out what is my best plan of attack. And that objective becomes written, or is written typically this way: determine attack plan. Okay, that's what is often said. Then we list all of those objectives coming from that. All right. Once we have the determination, and that depends on lots of situations and circumstances, then we develop the curriculum and the training scenarios, and then we figure out how to determine the training effectiveness, or we come up with a training effectiveness rating through the process of outcome projection. All right, so these are highly technical terms that we're using, and those that are trained in instructional system design probably understands where I'm coming from, but it's a discipline. So we're bringing in a design discipline to the process of trying to figure out how we are going to employ these assets, these adversary assets, so as to improve the enhance the close in air combat capabilities of our fighter forces with respect to a near peer adversary. How exactly are we going to do that? Okay, so that's what we had to do in order to pull this whole initiative off. Now, let me go back and just outline again what we're talking about. Before we're going to leave just temporarily, we're going to leave this whole idea of the curriculum. Okay. The curriculum comes out of a schoolhouse, but we weren't a schoolhouse. We were an extension of a schoolhouse. A schoolhouse was at that time the Navy Fighter Weapons School. Today it's called something different, but it means essentially the same thing. Today it's Air Warfare Center. I think the term is Air Warfare Development Center. I think that's the term that they're using currently to describe what exactly is the Navy Fighter Weapons School doing or what exactly is Top Gun. Okay. In order for us to take the Top Gun training model to sea or to an aircraft carrier environment, in order for us to do that, we had to have the following in place. Number one, we had to have the right airplanes, and we had to have the properly trained pilots. We had to have expert mechanics to work on and repair the airplanes. And we had to have committed professional support personnel, not least of which was the intelligence officers in the squadron and the maintenance officers in the squadron, the maintenance personnel, senior and enlisted, and all the way down to airmen, and so forth and so on. We also had to have the proper what we call tankers, right? So basically tankers are airborne fuel, okay? Our airborne extra fuel that was needed was not being carried by us. It was being carried by another airplane, if you will. We call it a tanker airplane, all right? So we had to have tanker resources available. We call them tanker supports, right? So this is airborne fuel. Okay, had to have that. We had to have launch priority and recovery priority. All right, so we had to be able to launch and recover on a priority basis. So we were given priority during the launch and recovery cycles. Okay, these are specific times in which the aircraft carrier launches airplanes, and then a different time in which the aircraft carrier recovers airplanes. Typically, they don't do that together. Sometimes they do. Nevertheless, we have launch periods and we have recovery periods, and we had to have, and we were given, launch and recovery priority. We had additional maintenance manpower that we were able to acquire. We also had additional spare parts that were stocked aboard the aircraft carrier, and we had certain insurance items that were either stocked aboard the aircraft carrier, the USS Constellation, or they were placed in a forward position, which was, in this case, the Philippines, because we had a naval base at that time in the Philippines. And so that was our forward location in which we were basically resupplied during the course of our long deployment cycle. Okay. So we had all those resources in place. Okay, getting those resources in place was a monumental effort. It took a lot of work, took a lot of cooperation, and we got it. We got it all in place. We also had some spare engines because we were going to be, we're going to be stressing the engines. We're going to be doing a lot of high-power operations, and so it puts a lot of stress and strain on these jet engines. And so we had to have some spare engines because the life cycle of these engines were not going to be very long. We would have to remove them. They would have to be sent back to the overhaul facility to put in new, for example, new turbines and stuff like that. So we had spare engines as well. Okay. So what did we do? Okay. We were able to set up this ongoing training program. It was mostly operational exercises, right? Sometimes we use the term training, but that's not exactly what it is or what it was. Right? It was more like we were going to perform these mission realistic air combat engagements, right? Against a near peer adversary. All right, so the F-14s were going to engage an adversary, and we were operating, and my unit was providing adversary support. What exactly does that mean? That means that we were the Red Forces. All right, we were on board the carrier, but we were operating as adversary resources or adversary support. We were providing the Red Forces, all right? So when the F-14s wanted to exercise their abilities to perform close-in aerial combat, we were there to provide them with the mission-realistic adversary support that they needed in order to perfect their skill sets with regard to close-in aerial combat. Okay, that's exactly what we did. All right, so that hopefully I am explaining how is it that we came to do this and what is a, let me go back to the question here. The question is how did the first deployed Top Gun unit come about? And I'm explaining that, but the biggest challenge that we had, once we had the resources, the necessary resources in place so as to actually do such a thing, we had to figure out, okay, what are the training objectives? How did we go from the mission objectives to the training objectives, or what are the experiences that we want to put in place so the fighter pilots get better in this environment? What is it? All right. So, and we did that. We were able to take a look at a number of things. And I'm going to kind of go fast forward here. And I know I'm covering a lot of ground here, and I'm trying to, you know, keep my wits about me, but the bottom line of this whole experience was we had to address ourselves to energy management, and that became the number one terminal proficiency objective, or the number one human or pilot training objective, if you want to use that term. Energy management. Why did we have to do that? Well, because of a number of things. Number one is that this operating in three dimensions is not typically done by humans. So humans don't humans don't operate very well in the vertical. Okay, so operating in the vertical became essential. Why is that? Because operating in the vertical, as well as the horizontal, gives you better abilities to manage your energy. Okay, so we are converting kinetic energy to potential energy, back to kinetic energy, and so forth and so on. Okay, what is kinetic energy? Kinetic energy is velocity. Okay, now you want to know what the kinetic energy equation is, you can look it up. That's easy enough. You can look at all of the energy laws, if you will, and read about that stuff. Okay, just to let you know, I have looked it up. The kinetic energy equation is 1/2 mv squared. V squared. Keep that in mind. The mass typically doesn't change. It actually does change a little bit in the fighter community because you're burning fuel. So the mass changes a bit, or the weight a bit. Not a whole lot, but it does change somewhat. But velocity is the big variable. Velocity can change dramatically, and you're squaring the velocity. Okay, so that's kinetic energy. You can convert kinetic energy to potential energy by having an altitude advantage with respect to the enemy aircraft. Okay, an altitude advantage. It's also called delta A, if you will. Delta is the change, and A is altitude. You want to have a plus delta A. You want to have an altitude advantage with respect to the enemy forces. Okay, good enough. Fine. Okay, and you can go back and forth. You can take your kinetic energy and convert it to potential energy, and then come back down and then convert that back to kinetic energy, and on and on and on and on. You should be able to do that endlessly until you run out of gas. Okay, so that was the big challenge. How do you do that? And so we had terminal proficiency objectives in mind that directly addressed this whole issue of energy management. My position is that whatever you are doing, it doesn't matter. And I'm taking this outside the domain of the fighter pilot and just saying that this applies across the board for all human endeavors. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You have to be able to manage energy. You have to learn how to do it, and you have to be effective energy managers. Really? Yes. Isn't that the same as, revenue or money? Or no, it's not. No, it's far cry from that. Energy management, we can get into that later, but energy management is very complex but extremely important, and it's vital to mission success. I claim that the number one key to mission success is energy management. All right, so that became our terminal proficiency objective. The number one performance objective was, during this period of time, was energy management. Okay, and that's what we were involved with. That's what we are doing so as to improve or enhance the close in air combat skills of the F-14 flight crew community. That's what we were doing. Did we do that? Well, I would say yes, we did. We were really quite successful in that endeavor. We were providing some rather, I would say, amazingly good training exercises that were designed such that this energy management effort, if you will, or energy management emerged as the primary objective, and the effectiveness was determined by eventually by positional advantage. All right, so we're converting velocity into energy, and we're taking energy and converting that further into a positional advantage because we had achieved better energy management during the dogfight. That's what we were doing, and that's what we were all about. Now, you can go back to the Top Gun movie, okay, and take a look at the Top Gun Maverick movie. What were they doing when Maverick announced, "Good morning, aviators. This is your captain speaking. Today's exercise will be basic flight maneuvers, dogfighting." That's what he said, okay? He said, "Guns only," kind of an important statement there, "guns only," which means that this is purely close-in air combat, okay? Purely, all right? No missiles, and the hard deck is 5,000 feet. Okay, so the fight's on. Okay, what is that? What's going on then when the fight is on? What's going on then? Okay, we are dealing with all the airplanes had achieved a certain energy level. But what Maverick was doing is he was doing better energy conversion. He was managing his energy better. Okay, so he blows through the formation. Okay, was he at a low velocity or was he at a high velocity? Well, as it turns out, he was at a high velocity. So he blows through the formation. He's at a very high velocity. He converts that velocity into a tactical advantage. But what he's actually doing, he is converting the energy into a tactical advantage. Okay, that's what he's doing. All right, so that became our reason for being, and that was the primary terminal proficiency objective during the course of these close-in air combat exercises that we were doing while on deployment aboard the USS Constellation. All right, so we're getting how close are, I'm asking my audio engineer, how close to the end are we? Okay, she's telling me I've got 2 minutes to go. All right, so I better hurry up and close off this discussion then, shouldn't I? She's shaking her head. Yes. Yes, I should. Okay, so where are we? Okay, we are answering the question. Okay, which is, how did this all come about? This all came about because of what the F-14 community wanted, what they requested from us, and their desire to improve, to optimize their close-in air combat performance against a near-peer adversary. And we did that while on deployment aboard the USS Constellation, again, one of the first group of supercarriers that we had in the U.S. Navy. Okay. It came about because it was requested. We responded to the request. Okay, when I say we, okay, my squadron, all right, or better yet, it was actually the air wing, all right, so the air wing responded to the request from the fighter squadrons that were part of the air wing. We addressed ourselves to their request. We provided them with the necessary air combat engagement resources, and we were successful. What did we learn? Well, we learned that first and foremost, we have to be able to manage energy better. Our energy management capabilities was not, and likely today even is not, as good as it could be, as good as it should be. Energy management was and is the key to mission success. All right. Are we at the end of the show? We are. Okay. We are at the end. My audio engineer is telling me we're at the end of another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast. Yes, we are. Okay. Thank you for listening, and we will see you all next week.